Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Armistead Maupin first introduced readers to the cast of 28 Barbary Lane, including the beloved transgender landlady Anna Madrigal, in the 1970s with a groundbreaking newspaper serial. That serial went on to become a series of 8 best-selling novels and a Peabody Award-winning miniseries. Now 35 years after Tales of the City was published, Maupin takes us back to San Francisco for the 9th and final book in the series. It is a great pleasure to welcome Armistead Maupin to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
A delight to have you on the program. At what point do you decide finality, fictionally speaking?
Oh, there were a number of reasons from my standpoint. First of all, I am getting older, and I had some concerns about introducing younger characters and making them realistic, not doing some weird sort of youth speak that didn't ring true, because I've always been true to my own what's happening to me. So most of my characters, and many of the characters, are over 50, and I know what's going on there. I have some younger ones that I understand pretty well, but I was kind of ready to do it. And I realized that there could be a shape to the ending that would be very satisfying for people who'd read all 9 books. Each one of them, I've attempted to make them self-sufficient. You can pick up any one of the 9 Tales of the City books and understand it. But I also had that overall arc, and I saw a way I could end it and make it work for everybody.
What are the challenges of doing what you just said, of taking a book and having a series go 9 books in a series and still have them stand alone as well?
Well, I learned the lesson very early on to take it a little bit at a time, because I was writing 5 days a week in a daily newspaper, and each of those little units had to be self-contained. So I think I just kind of, my brain became wired to do it. I don't really know how to describe it. I would just trust my own instincts to the characters, which ones I would like to have back again, which ones I missed, who to rotate out, who to put into a minor role, who to give full attention to. I guess it's like managing an orphanage or a very large family.
Tales of the City was conceived in 1976 and, as we mentioned, has resulted in 9 books. So there's obviously a reason bringing you back to those characters again and again.
Well, I was aware that I had a continuing story that people were following, and that's enormous power and a great deal of pleasure on the part of the writer to have people coming back and saying, I can't wait to see what they're doing now. It gives you a certain confidence after a while and a certain determination to keep it going. The thing I hear most often from readers, especially now, is it's like a reunion with old friends. And when you have that going for you to begin with, then you can really feel the confidence that you can tell the story and they're going to care about what happens to these people.
Given this almost 40 years that you have been writing about these characters and this place, I'm curious as to whether it does it not mirror your life, but you can sort of see the reflection in it by looking back at the 9 novels.
Some things that I wasn't even aware of at the time, you know, certain emotional states of mind that showed up in the novel that were really very revealing about myself. Some of the incidents, some of the things that happened to them actually happened to me, so it feels kind of like a diary. I mean, I, you know, two of the novels were based on cruises that I took on ships, trips to Great Britain, breakups that I had, things that happened to my friends. I can read the book and see my life on every page. I don't think most people can, but I can, and it's been a wonderful tool in terms of trying to lend reality to what I'm writing. And I have to say there's something a little, I've been thinking about this the last 2 days on the road, because you can get a little existential. It's a little melancholy to be ending it. It really is. I'm feeling it now for the first time because it's so tied in with my own life. And to end it almost feels as if I'm, not quite ending my own life, but certainly ending a very big chapter. And part of the reason I did it was for the the chance to have some air in there and figure out where I want to go next, to have one more adventure.
So the book,
I'll be 70 in May, so I'm allowed a few more. But
absolutely. The title of the book is The Days of Anna Madrigal, and in the book she is 92 and pretty fragile, but considering and thinking about her demise and looking to leave this earth like a lady.
Yes, that's the term she uses, leaving like a lady. She's always had a real self-possession about her. From the very beginning, she's been a kind of wise character who manages to have a sense of humor about her situation, no matter what it is. I like her very much. She's sort of a higher self. Many of the other characters are little bits and pieces of me. Anna is what I would hope to be when the time comes.
What do you think it is about her that inspires the loyalty that this character has with audiences?
Well, you know, I've been asked that, and I think maybe it has to do with, you know, she used to be a landlady, and all of these other characters were in her house. She was notorious for taping joints onto the door of their rooms when they took lodgings there at 28 Barbary Lane. And I think it's precisely the fact that she is a sort of parental figure without the usual parental judgment. She just wants her children, as she says, her tenants, to be happy. So they come and tell her everything. And as a consequence, there's a greater intimacy, precisely because she doesn't have some agenda for them based on the fact that she gave birth to them. And I think that's why people love her so much. I think a lot of people, especially today, are craving that kind of non-judgmental parental figure. I make a distinction between the biological and the logical family. Anna makes that distinction. She says, "This isn't my biological family. This is my logical family," meaning that these people have been drawn together because of their friendship and love for each other, and not a requirement of birth.
Does the male-female duality of her life make her an especially intuitive character to write?
Absolutely. The fact that I once said a nice old lady who used to be a man could very well know what's on everyone's mind. And I believe that. I believe that about my transgender friends. They've had a much harder row to hoe than I have. And secondly, they challenge my assumptions about gender, about what someone should be like, whether they're adhering to gender roles or not. You're forced with a transgender person to think about the person who's there. And that's what we should be doing about everyone that we meet and love. Find the person, find the part that isn't male or female or gay or straight or young or old or black or white. Just who's the person at the core there? And I think that's what Anna represents, my effort to find that in everybody. And I think that's why people love her so much.
And this novel gives us a glimpse into her boyhood, into what it was, really a full scope of her life. She's 92 in the novel, but we get to look back.
We look back to 1936 and the brothel where she grew up in Winnemucca, Nevada. I thought that was going to be scary at first, writing outside of real time, because I've always written in real time. I've always just gathered the Easter eggs in my immediate vicinity. And I've never done a flashback. I've never gone back into the past. And I found it enormously satisfying to escape in that way, to time travel. And the information that I needed was on the internet. I must say, writers have this wonderful tool now where you can Google 1930s brothel menu, and you will see what was available at a brothel in 1936. Some very mysterious names. I had to look up them.
And those are specifics, of course, but I assume you had in your mind for a while the background of this character, of the roots of where she came from as a person.
Well, early in the series, she reunites with her mother after many, many years.
Right.
But yes, I had an image of it, but it was completely my own invention. It wasn't until summer before last that my husband and I took a cross-country trip, and we just decided to go through Winnemucca because I had been writing about it for 35 years and had never seen it. So that was pretty fascinating. And we found places that had been there in Anna's boyhood days. There aren't many, but there were one or two. And they figure in the novel, and I was able to flesh out the details in really interesting ways and find the road where I imagined that the brothel would have been. And we drove down that road and couldn't stop driving because there was nothing on it, and we were fascinated. We went for 60 miles until we realized that if we had gone for 100 miles, we would have connected with the northern part of the Black Rock Desert, which is where the Burning Man Festival is held every year. And by the strangest coincidence, that's also Burning Man is plays a big part in the days of Anna Madrigal. The characters converge on this completely phantasmagorical arts festival in the middle of nowhere. Explaining that, by the way, was something of a challenge too, because it's a visual like you've never seen. I ended up calling it a Fellini carnival on Mars, because I hope it's not indescribable, because I worked very hard to describe it, but it's quite an extraordinary place.
Well, you describe it very vividly and beautifully, and it would seem in the description that you've written about that you enjoyed it. There seems to be some fondness.
Well, somewhat like Michael. I found my way there. my husband dragged me kicking and screaming the first time we went. We've been for 2 years now, because the thought of extraordinary dust and heat and having to bring in all your own food and water and the noise of an all-night rave, that sort of thing made me into a very grumpy old man until I actually got there and realized how much fun it was to put on a sarong and bicycle across a big flat plain and just be crazy and free with a lot of other people doing the same thing and a great deal of kindness all around you. There's real effort at community and that sort of thing. So I was won over, and as much as that's reflected in the book, I think.
Armistead Maupin is our guest. The new novel is The Days of Anna Madrigal, and it is published by Harper. Given that you have been witness to the rise of gay culture in this country and the many ups and downs, I assume this wasn't a conscious, something that you did consciously, but these books very much reflect that roller coaster ride.
Oh, it was quite conscious.
It was.
It really was. From the very beginning, yeah. Maybe not the first book. I was just kind of sticking my toe in the water. I wasn't even out to my parents, even though I was writing a story with gay characters in it. And when Anita Bryant began her anti-gay campaign in South Florida in 1977, I was angry, like a lot of other people I knew, and realized something had to be done. So by the most serendipitous coincidence, I had established Michael Tolliver, the gay character, as the son of Florida orange growers. And Anita Bryant, if you remember, was the spokesperson for Florida orange juice.
Yes.
So there was a tie-in in which Michael's mother writes him and tells him very excitedly that she's joined the Save Our Children campaign, as it was called. And Michael writes back and said, "I'm one of them, and I don't need any saving." And it served as my coming out letter to my parents. And from that point on, I was a completely politicized human being when it came to my sexual identity. I was tired after some. I was 32. I was tired of 32 years of pretending not to be who I was, and angry that something so beautiful, namely the full expression of sexuality, whatever that might be, was a reason for criticizing and beyond criticizing, persecuting. I had had 30 some years, maybe 30, 20, almost 30 years of being not only a mental illness but a crime back in my home state of North Carolina. Mm. So I wanted to let the world see what I was feeling, that this was ridiculous, that I'd ever spent a moment worrying about who I was and that I wasn't going to put up with it anymore. And that the best way I could do that was just show how damn much fun these people are having in San Francisco who are gay, straight, and stray, as I say sometimes, because they were, you know, friends with each other and living together and sharing their lives and not judging. And I think a lot of people jumped on that wagon precisely because it made them feel the same way. And so, I am very much part of what the radical right calls the gay agenda. I have been all along, never tried to hide it, and I'm very proud of it.
And in writing for all those years, both in these novels and also in the series for the San Francisco Chronicle, this was, you were basically telling the world outside of this community that you're very much a part of, that it was possible for gay and straight and stray to form a family and to be together.
Yes, I was a little chauvinistic about it at the beginning because I thought, well, this is this magical world we have in San Francisco. But as soon as I started touring with the books, everywhere I went, if I was in Edinburgh, someone would say, this is my Mrs. Madrigal and this is my Michael Tolliver. And they'd bring their logical families with them to the book signing. And I realized it was happening to the entire world. It was, or at least to most of the Western world. The big challenge now is to make life easier for kids in Nigeria and Russia and all of those places where there are actively vicious laws on the books as we speak. But I didn't. I was taking that idea everywhere I could. Everywhere I could get it.
So in talking to you, you seem very happy and delighted by the advances of this movement, but not ultimately surprised.
No, I'm a little annoyed it's taken so long, really.
Yeah.
But that, like a lot of people, I'm still enormously moved when I see a moment of progress. My husband and I had a day home back in Santa Fe from, you know, to take a rest from the book tour. And we just watched the Grammys when Macklemore did that, the rap song that won about homophobia. And I was already moved by that, both of us sitting there just weeping, holding hands on the sofa like a couple of teenagers. Mm. Because it was such a moment. And then when they did that, they married all those gay and straight couples and said it's all the same thing. It was an extraordinary leap forward. I've seen people online being cynical about it, saying, oh, big publicity stunt or whatever. Well, yeah, it was a publicity stunt for a human rights revolution. And it was there in the middle of a huge commercial project that would traditionally in the past have just kept it out, would not have allowed it to happen. But to me, it showed what degree the attitudes have changed. That, of course, and the way in which same-sex marriage is now it's no longer seeping in from the coast the way people always say that it was. You know, the influence of those wicked people in New York and San Francisco. Now it's happening in Oklahoma and Utah, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
Which led the fight against marriage equality in California when we had it happening there. So I have, in one sense, even though I think the world is harder for all of us, gay and straight, you know, it's there are pressures that we feel that we haven't felt in the past just because of the enormity of things and the speed with which life moves because of the internet. The great side effect of that is I think that humanity is compassion and tolerance are greater because we can see each other. We know who we are now. And my goal from the beginning with Tales of the City was to argue that we won't change this until our families and friends know who we are. You must come out of the closet. Mm. I was a little piqued, I have to say, that Queen Latifah was the person that did that marriage on the Grammys. I didn't feel she'd earned that moment. But that's been my theme from the very beginning.
And when you talk about your career and what you have done and what you were looking to do and having this agenda, well, what's interesting in your writing career, and maybe you feel differently about this, but it seems to me that through all that, you still have managed commercial mainstream success.
Well, it was tricky. Yes, thank you. I'm proud of that. This story first appeared in a family newspaper in San Francisco, and that means everybody read it. And it means that I was always fighting with the editors about what was going to go into this thing. It was a tight wire act from the very beginning. But I think that's happened because I didn't allow myself to be categorized. There was no fiction whatsoever, very few things. Before the 70s that dealt with gay life. And then when suddenly it was an acceptable subject, it became a genre, it became a niche in fiction. It became something called gay fiction. And they put a naked guy on the cover and sold it to this little market. And my intention all along from the beginning has been to sell this story to everyone because I thought everyone needed to hear it. And that gay people felt better when they saw themselves in the woven into the overall tapestry of life, and straight folks who were struggling with the notion of their gay neighbors and how to be with them found courage in it as well. So I've tried to make it mainstream all along. I've never found anything wicked about that word. Some radical queer theorists talk about mainstreaming as if it's selling out. Mm. I think selling out is creating a little niche for yourself that nobody else ever reads, and so that you can continue to feel oppressed. It's hard to have conversations with people who aren't like us, and that's exactly what I've been trying to do for the last 40 years.
We only have a moment left, but as we wrap up, as this series comes to a close, have you decided what to do next?
I'm allowing myself a little breathing room, but the mortgage has to be paid, so there'll be something soon. I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm thinking in the direction of a memoir.
That'd be great.
I've never really talked about my own life, which has been pretty interesting in and of itself. Don't know whether there's enough there. I don't want to bore people. And also along the same lines, the idea of a one-man show, something that allows me to get on stage, which I really love, and tell stories. And I can travel. Chris and I have talked about getting an Airstream trailer and doing a little sort of Uncle Armistead's medicine show, maybe have a guitar player or something. Who knows?
Hitting the road.
We're going to hit the road and go back to basics in this time of economic depression.
The name of the novel is The Days of Anna Madrigal. It is by Armistead Maupin and is published by Harper. Armistead, thank you so much for spending time with us. Best of luck with the new novel. A delight to speak with you.
Thank you. It has been for me, too.
Thank you very much. Again, Armistead Maupin's latest is The Days of Anna Madrigal. It is published by Harper. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.